Empire Lines uncovers the unexpected, often two-way, flows of empires through art. Interdisciplinary thinkers use individual artworks as artifacts of imperial exchange, revealing the how and why of the monolith empire.
In this episode, Dr. Saigon Salgala mines the hidden link between four early modern empires. In a 17th century painting of silver laborers in Potosi, Bolivia.
In the shadow of a rocky mountain, three laborers huddle together along a diagonal line. Although they are barefoot, their costumes of colorful turbans, short tunics, and pants seem too pristine and too fancy for the work that they're doing. In the distance, two figures sit on their knees. Symmetrically mirroring each other, they break stones with small pickaxes. The laborer in the foreground, on the other hand, is standing up, shoveling away the stones that the others have just broken. Breaking stones is backbreaking work, obviously hard and exhausting. Yet, the facial expressions of these men convey neither a sense of anguish nor minor discomfort, as they look mesmerized and in a state of trance. Behind them, a river flows from the mountain, but the rocks appear to be retreating to reveal a grand architectural landscape. Next to a monumental canopy on four columns, we see a city of domes, minarets, and eons. From the leaves of the rising trees to the laborers' costumes, the color palette is vibrant, but also soothing. Whatever labor the three men are performing, it seems to be conducted calmly, with no hardship, in a paradise-like setting. This painting, from the early 17th century, is a folio detached from an unusual manuscript currently held in Dublin's Chester Beatty Library. The manuscript is entitled Translation of the History of the New World, and its introduction states that it is the Persian translation of a Turkish text entitled History of the New World, produced by an Ottoman scholar named Ahizade Ali Çelebi. If that is true, then the Turkish original has been lost, and Ahizade Ali Çelebi is impossible to locate in the Ottoman sources. In fact, the manuscript is most likely the translation of another well-known Ottoman manuscript, and the attribution to Ahizade Ali Çelebi is the translator's mistake. Alongside the attribution of its text to a non-existent Ottoman original, what makes this translation unusual are the debated provenances of its paintings. They have been interchangeably identified as Persian and South Asian, more specifically Deccani. Certain clues suggest the site of production was one of the Deccani Sultanates, possibly the court of the Adi Shahi dynasty, who ruled the present-day Bijapur district roughly between the early 16th and late 17th centuries. Yet, all such clues pointing towards the Adi Shahi court are circumstantial, and the stylistic indicators for our painting are significantly weak. Wherever this painting was produced, it was done so with such a specific idea in mind that the painting became, in a sense, unlocatable to its locale, or to any locale for that matter. Indeed, we only know that this painting is about silver mining in Bolivia because of the Persian text on the verso. As such, the three laborers of the painting unintentionally speak to the unspoken interconnections between four imperial domains in the 17th century, namely South Asia, Safavid Iran, the Ottoman Empire, and the Spanish Empire. It speaks to how the organization of labor in all four empires was gradually shifting towards earlier forms of wage labor and new organizational models in line with earlier experimentations with capitalist modes of production. By the late 16th century, the Ottoman Empire controlled extensive territories in East and Southeast Europe, North Africa, and the Middle East. As a recognized military power, they were actively involved in European diplomacy, but they were also significant commercial actors. They controlled the maritime and land routes to South Asia and East Asia, which still maintained their importance despite the circumnavigation of Africa. The Ottomans were also actively present in the Indian Ocean, competing and fighting with the Portuguese. It was in this context, in 1583, that the Ottoman Sultan Murad III was presented with the new report, more popularly known as the History of the West Indies. Based on the Italian translations of numerous Spanish accounts on the Americas, including Francisco López de Gomara's Historia de las Indias, This was the first text on the Americas in a non-European language. Importantly, the new report was not commissioned by Murat III, but presented to him. According to Baki Tezcan, its patrons were members of the so-called Indian Ocean faction, a group in the Ottoman court who campaigned for Ottoman domination in the Indian Ocean against the Portuguese. The manuscript was completed shortly before the renewal of the Ottoman-Spanish peace in 1583, and shortly after the Spanish and Portuguese crowns were united in 1580. With its paintings depicting the Spanish as formidable enemies, it was intended to convince Murat III against renewing the peace, which, because of the Spanish-Portuguese unification, would have now extended into the Indian Ocean as well. This anti-Spanish content is missing in later copies of the new report, and also in this Persian translation. But one thing remains a constant: novelty. Like the frontispiece of the English Lord Chancellor Francis Bacon's The Great Instauration, first published in 1620, the later copies of the new report and our Persian translation propagated the idea that knowledge of the Americas were not contained in the knowledge of the ancients. This included the sayings of the Prophet Muhammad too, hence the title, The New Report, or Hadisine, meaning the new Hadith. This brings us back to this particular painting of our stone-cutting laborers. Given that it is taken from a book about the Americas, given the emphasis on novelty, this image should surely depict a scene in the Americas. And yet, we see turbaned laborers in tunics, before an architectural landscape of domes, iwans, and minarets. The Persian text on the verso repeats verbatim the relevant section in the new report, hence my suggestion that the source of the translation must be the new report and not a non-existent manuscript by a non-existent Ahizade Ali Çelebi. And the text is specifically about the digging of holes and the construction of furnaces that would be used for mining, which overlaps with the painting almost perfectly. Therefore, in our painting, the three laborers are not mining. Indeed, mining would have taken place on the mountain in the background. Rather, they are digging and building furnaces. This also overlaps with the images in the 17th century Ottoman copies of the New Report, where we either see people marveling at the completed furnaces, or in the process of building them under the supervision of an overseer. Still, in all these other instances, including a supposed human sacrifice scene in the translation, there is an effort by the artist to distinguish the figures as not Ottoman or not South Asian. So why not in this painting too? This anomaly is a symptom of abstraction, not the abstraction of art, but of labor. In the centuries that saw the earlier glimpses of wage labor and capitalist modes of production, labor was becoming so abstract that, to quote from the author Chaime Yeville, people were no longer workers, but the human shapes of wage labor itself. In such increasing levels of abstraction, labor and laborers could be concretized into any local vernacular. Similarly, a given depiction of labor could be removed from the specific context to which it refers. It could become a floating signifier that could be concretized into any practice of organizing labor and orienting production towards the newly globalizing markets, be it mining-related, agricultural, artisanal, or proto-industrial. We know that this particular painting is related to silver mining in Potosí, now in Bolivia, simply because of the accompanying text. Prior to the Spanish conquest and colonization in 1572, Bolivia was part of the Inca Empire. After executing Tupac Amaru I, the last heir to the royal Inca line, the Spanish viceroy, Toledo, began restructuring the silver mining in the region into what he deemed to be the most efficient system. With tremendous increase in output, Potosí's silver mines and the imperial villa became glimmering global celebrities, the gossip of European capitals and also Ottoman Istanbul. But Potosí was also materially present in the rest of the world. Its silver flooded into European, Persian, Ottoman, and South Asian markets, fueling trans-Pacific trade with East Asia and the Portuguese slave trade between West Africa and Buenos Aires. Potosí silver could be found anywhere. Wherever this particular painting was made, its artist or workshop was indeed likely paid in silver from Potosí. Such exploitation of silver generated tremendous wealth for the colonial Spanish elite. But looking at this idealistic painting begs the question of how such wealth was really generated, and particularly, how this silver was mined in Potosí. Potosí mining labor was coerced from the indigenous Inca population. It wasn't slavery per se, because the miners received some payment. But in today's terminology, that fee would be significantly below a living or minimum wage. Villages and farming communities in an area stretching as far as 1,000 kilometers from Potosí had to provide 16% of their able-bodied men for mining. On top of that, there were also free miners earning something close to a minimum wage. Despite receiving criticism, even in his own time, Viceroy Toledo's system remained in effect until 1825. In the 16th and 17th century Ottoman Empire, mining labor was similarly composite. It included slave labor, mostly prisoners of war, paid but coerced labor from nearby villages, and the paid labor of experienced miners deported to newly opened mines. Whether a mine was under strict imperial control or outsourced to tax farmers, it operated with the same logic of extracting as much as possible with as little expense as possible to satisfy the demands of a newly globalizing market. Despite its vast territories in West Asia, Safavid Iran lacked its own silver mines. But the demand for the precious metal was so high that Iran made its industries and agriculture more efficient, so that it could trade more goods for silver from the East India Company and the Portuguese. In the late 16th and 17th centuries, Iran organized its silk industry, including its labor force, under the Armenian family firms in Isfahan. Tobacco production also became a market-oriented enterprise, under the control of wealthy landowners and merchants. They successfully reorganized a segment of the peasantry into cash crop-growing laborers. In neighboring Mughal India, most urban and agrarian labor was sustained by wages in cash. Although coerced labor was rare, the caste system, despite immense variations across time and space, brought a unique rigidity to labor organization. Still, as in Safavid Iran, in the Ottoman Empire, and over the Americas, production was similarly geared towards globalizing markets with a keen eye on silver. By 1600, this had allowed the Mughals to accumulate enough Spanish colonial silver for an annual output of 300 tons of silver coins. In the same centuries, almost simultaneous with England, the Ottoman Empire also experienced the first land enclosures, which turned peasants into laborers at the mercy of local elites and tax farmers. Whether colonial or land-based, these different 17th century empires all restructured their labor forces either to mine silver or to produce cash-generating goods and produce which could be traded for silver in the global markets. There were obvious differences from one production site to the other, but the underlying logic by which labor could be abstracted and translated into any local vernacular was the same. In this period of transition to wage labor and capitalist modes of production, our painting of symmetrically and harmoniously working laborers evokes an ancient formula, one repeated across style, medium, and genre. This pattern can be traced back to the antiquity, from the tombstones of Roman artisans to Trajan's column. It appears in the depiction of builders that beam from the ceiling frescoes of the 8th century Umayyad summer palace in Kasramra. We see it in the biotapestry and in the stained glass windows of the Chartres Cathedral. Peasants toil in the 13th century Arabic Book of Antidotes from Anatolia, following the same formula, just as their counterparts in the Book of Hours of Duke of Berry, painted by the Limborg brothers in 1416 and in a manner closest to our painting. Finally, the artisanal labor scenes in the Ottoman Imperial Festival Book of 1582 and the architectural labor scene in the early 17th century Mughal Akbarnama are all rendered with one or another version of the same formula. Back to back, facing each other, or along a diagonal line, men and women work in metric rhythm. This is pictorially communicated through a visual symmetry that mechanizes labor into a disciplined, obedient, and harmonious performance. even where symmetry is missing. As in the 17th century Ottoman copies of the New Report, the presence of an overseer ensures that labor is performed under strict control. Our painting may not be unique in summoning this millennial formula, but it is unlike its Ottoman and Mughal contemporaries that show specific and locatable scenes of labor. Rather, it abstracts the concrete coerced labor of indigenous miners in Potosi so that it can be reconcretized into various local practices of organizing labor from West to South Asia. This painting is thus all about novelty, though not necessarily the novelty of the colonized Americas and its silver mines. It is about the novelty of the contemporary, the not yet wage labor that was producing, sustaining, and expanding empires across the globe. These painted labors speak to the overlooked connection between early modern empires, a connection that was not maintained by the silver and goods that circulated among the empires, but through their overlapping efforts to reorganize labor and to restructure laborers' relationship to new regimes of production. Just as in Chartres, or in the Book of Hours of Duke of Berry, our painting does not depict an actual state of obedience and harmony. By abstracting the concrete situation in Potosi, where indigenous laborers, particularly women who controlled the mills, ingeniously resisted and bypassed colonial exploitation, the painting presents its patron with the imaginary imperial ideal. It is here, then, in labor, in resistance, and in rebellion, that we find the overlooked connection between early modern empires, one that this painting unintentionally unveils.
Empire Lines is produced by Yelena Sofroniewicz. For more episodes, subscribe wherever you get your podcasts.